Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Professor Corey Dolgan will join us in a moment to talk about his important new book called Kill It to Save It, an autopsy on capitalism's triumph over democracy. We're going to talk about the Republican efforts to kill healthcare, to save tax cuts, their efforts to kill public education, to save charter schools, and much more. There are a bunch of killers on the loose. And they reside in Washington, D.C. This podcast is made possible by the subscriptions from listeners like Arlene Montemarano, Benny Alto, Aiden McAleer, and Jane Williams. Thanks to each and every one of you for your support. May I invite you, yeah, you with the earbuds there, to become a subscriber? Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on menu, pull it down, then click on become a subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page. You got to whole range of options. See what fits your budget. And if you pop $50 for an annual subscription, I'll send you a bonus book. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, Professor Corey Dolgan joins us to talk about his powerful new book, Kill It to Save It, an autopsy of capitalism's triumph over democracy. There is a brazen heist underway, a class war, and we are losing. The people with money are getting more money, and the rest of us are left to fight over the scraps. Corey Dolgan has written this amazing new book, and I'm really in sync with much of his thinking. It's called Kill It to Save It. And Corey Dolgan is a sociologist, and he's professor of sociology, director of community-based learning at Stonehill College in Easton, Massachusetts, a past president of the Association for Humanist Sociology. He's taught at Harvard and at Clark University, and he's written three other books. Professor, thanks for joining me today here on the Peter B. Collins podcast.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
I really got a lot out of your book. It echoes many of the ideas and sentiments that I've been expressing for quite a while. And I want to start with the historic struggle underway right now as the Republican majority in the U.S. Senate, and we're speaking during the July 4th summer break, they are scheming on conference calls and I'm sure texting furiously, trying to come up with the sweet spot, trying to decide just how many Americans to put at risk for misery and death by denying them access to health care. And I think this fits right into your analysis here, that they explained to us that they've got to kill Obamacare to save something. We're not quite sure what.
No, I think that's absolutely right. A couple of points that I would probably try to clarify. First of all, I think it's very important that we don't call this a health care bill. This is a tax cut bill.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very clear that it's set out to move billions, if ultimately not trillions of dollars, from the public sector, where it's supposed to do the public's good, in this case, providing health care, to the pockets of the wealthy.
Indeed, so, it is a reverse Robin Hood scheme, and you use that that phrase in your book. And I share
right.
your concern over the nomenclature here. I cringe every night when I watch the public television news hour, and they refer to this as healthcare reform. It's not reforming a damn thing. It is cutting access to healthcare, and it is going to be used as the pretext to shovel more money into the deep pockets of the already wealthy.
No, that's right. And that's why I use the phrase kill it to save it. I do think that in essence the reform language is a misnomer, and that it really is an effort to destroy the public sector. And while the reform language suggests it's to save it, it really is to destroy it for the privatization and for the benefit of the very rich and very powerful. I think that the sweet spot is an interesting way to put it, right? Because it certainly isn't really a calculus about how many people might not have health coverage or how many people may in fact die because of it. Although I do think those numbers are actually staggering. The issue is really about that transfer of wealth. And so the question is, how many Republicans believe that they can get away with it?
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a sweet spot, but the sweet spot in some ways is an unknowable, because it has to do with what is the future of our democracy actually going to look like if, in fact, we have one. And in this particular case, I keep hearing about the events that will go on, the town meetings and the other events in Republican senators' districts. And certainly I'm very hopeful that they will appear and be powerful. But that's really where we need to start. Those demonstrations aren't really the end of this struggle. They're really the beginning of what this very long struggle is going to be if we're actually going to establish or save some semblance of democracy.
And Corey, my reference to sweet spot is based on a comment from Republican Senator John Thune about a week ago. And he was speaking entirely in euphemisms. And so this was not about, you know, cutting Medicaid. This was about, he said, we can dial it up or dial it down. And this really is the language of the death panels that Sarah Palin fantasized about.
That's right. Well, I mean, you know, the entire debate has been ironic, but I think it's been ironic going back to Obamacare's establishment, which was, in essence, you know, the dialing up, right? Where, I mean, now you may be dialing down the amount of support that you're willing to give to the American public, especially poor working class people who need that help to cover their insurance. But in fact, from the very beginning, the right wing of the Democratic Party, which is the dominant wing these days, was very clear about not supporting single payer, mm-hmm. and in fact, not really supporting a public option. And once those opportunities went out the window, I would say that the irony of the situation was really simply one of, will we offer insurance coverage to more people or less? And so now that dialing up or dialing down to find the sweet spot has to do with what is the potential outrage of poor and working class people around the country. I would suggest the only sane system, a real healthcare policy, would be a single payer, which is what most of the industrialized world has. In fact, most of the world in general has. And it is the only sane way to create a healthcare policy that really takes care of the people in a nation.
Well, I agree. And, you know, I submit that the for-profit delivery of healthcare has been proven to fail. We can't control costs. The insurance companies extract an additional premium of roughly 30%. Added on to the cost of health care, and we know that the Veterans Administration and Medicare manage those services with a roughly 5% overhead. So the potential savings there are very clear. And I agree with you that going back to the early stages of the Obama administration, John Conyers, a very clear single-payer supporter, had to beg to get on the guest list to one of the White House kickoff parties for original discussions about Obama's health care reform. And I test drove health care under Obama using the California Exchange. My first year was a disaster with Anthem Blue Cross. I was out of network on virtually everything. I couldn't find a dermatologist within 60 miles that was actually willing to accept my second-class coverage. But that said, I was covered in the event of a major event like cancer or a surgical requirement. And so I accept that Obamacare was an improvement and that millions of Americans got coverage. But the Republican language to now is that because it's got Obama's name on it, even though it was based on conservative principles and it was a huge gift to Big Pharma and to the health insurers, we're now told that it's got to go. Grover Norquist has got to drown this thing in his bathtub.
That's right. That's right. Well, I think there are two things at work, and one that was at work throughout the Obama presidency, and I write about it quite a bit in the book, which is much of the corporate ideology that gets packaged and now infused really into our mass ideology, thinking about who we are as Americans, is surrounded and infused, it's kept alive and energized by white supremacy. And so when we think about the discussion around Obamacare and really most of the discussion now about the public sector, the idea of the public sector has actually, I would argue, been racialized. And so the people who need the public sector, whether it comes from education or healthcare or really any other of the goods and services that we've always considered part of our collective public good, the people who are counting on it and who need it are often demonized. They're often racialized, going back to Reagan and the idea of the welfare queen, mm-hmm. despite the fact that the majority of people who receive welfare payments are white.
Yeah.
The image of those who need welfare have been demonized and also racialized. And I think Obamacare was, if you think about the hypocrisy of those people who didn't want Obamacare, they didn't want any program that was being promoted by President Obama, but they wanted people to get their hands off of their own Medicare, mm-hmm. right? And so they could think of themselves as the quote-unquote worthy or deserving poor, while those people who were being supported by progressive policies are somehow the other.
Corey Dolgan is my guest. Kill It to Save It is his new book. And, Corey, did you read or hear the stunning remarks of Republican Speaker Paul Ryan recently when he basically declared that poor people choose to be poor and that he didn't want to reward their bad choices by continuing to provide Medicaid and safety net health care coverage? And I just find it amazing that he can say that. And while a few, you know, Elizabeth Warren types would fight back and deplore what he said, in general, this is seen as wisdom. This is, you know, treated as something that is tough love. It's strong medicine. But he's got the courage to deliver that.
No, that's right. And that's been part and parcel of the narrative, certainly since Reagan. And that is this kind of hyper-individualism. And the Kill It to Save It framework that I write about looks at this hyper-individualism and what I consider a kind of corporate ideology that has really become the baseline of an ideological instinct in this country. And so, for instance, that language of choice really rings true to Americans, in part because it has to do with what they, the power they have as consumers or the power they have as individuals to make a choice. And then this notion that somehow the corporate ideology, the corporate sector, handles all of these things so much more effectively and efficiently that if people just leave corporations alone, we now call them job creators, they will in fact give us the opportunities as individuals to make the right choices, and that will lead to our success. And of course, the problems with that logic are legion. The idea somehow that people choose to be poor or they've made bad choices, on the one hand, disregards the incredibly poor choices that rich people make day in and day out, yet seem to have a cushion. Someone like George Bush, I often like to use in my class as an example of someone who pretty much failed at everything he did, had a terrible substance abuse problem. Yet up until the age of 30 or 35, he floated on the fact that he came from one of the most wealthiest and powerful families in the country. And then suddenly, within 10 years, 15 years, was the president of the United States. So one can make very bad choices if one has wealth and power in this country. One can make extremely wonderful choices, be part of those working people that Paul Ryan suggests, Yet a company can go wrong, or anybody can come up with a health problem and suddenly go bankrupt. Mm-hmm. And so the notion that we can't create the infrastructure for everybody in this country to have the basic food, clothing, shelter, health care, and education that we all need and all desire and would make the choice to have seems to me a completely misguided analysis of how people become poor.
And Paul Ryan extends that into the argument over the individual mandate. He says, well, look, you know, people don't like to be forced to buy health insurance. And if, you know, 23 million are uninsured, those are people who choose not to be insured because they don't want the government forcing them to do it. Well, based on the figures I've seen, there may be a million people who actually paid a fine under the individual mandate clause. Right. And openly decided not to have coverage. But millions of people, somewhere in the range of 23 million, said, yes, I will submit to this mandate. And, Corey, what is even more insidious is that the language in the House bill, the language in the draft Senate bill, both of them eviscerate the employer mandate. And Obamacare only applies to a sliver of the American public, people like me who are self-employed. That's about 3%. And the Medicaid group, which is, you know, somewhere in the range of 20%. So the remainder are people who still enjoy employer subsidized, if not completely paid, health insurance on a pool basis that gives them great coverage at minimal out-of-pocket expense. And that is being wiped away if these measures become law. And I think most of the people who have employer-paid insurance today are completely oblivious to it.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And of course, they won't be oblivious to it once this bill passes, if in fact it does. But again, the framework from the get-go that we are suggesting that our healthcare policies are driven by the notion of health insurance always lets the market dictate the rules. So, you know, I mean, ultimately, I think it's obvious that Obama was played by the insurance companies, that the idea that you could set up these exchanges, but that you can also set up a larger policy only because of the individual mandate, only because that allowed the insurance companies to make the money that they needed to, that they wanted to make. And then the idea that there would be no control over the raising of premiums, and that in essence what Obama had promised was that the government would subsidize whatever the rise in the premiums would be. The fact of the matter was that it would be impossible to maintain that given the inexhaustible, unsatiable greed of insurance companies. So you have got to take a serious healthcare policy out of the hands of insurance companies, put it back in the hands of not only medical people, of doctors, as the right wing likes to suggest, let the doctors decide, right? But also guarantee it as a basic human right.
Corey, in your book, Kill It to Save It, you focus quite a bit on education. And we have Betsy DeVos, who donated millions to Republican causes in order to buy her seat as Secretary of Education. She's an heir to the Amway fortune, and I'm sure multi-level marketing and charter schools are going to sort out the real problems in our public education system today. As you look at this, once again, the fundamental focus you have is that we are killing public schools by siphoning off the money to charter schools, many of which are profitable but not achieving educational goals. And yet we have cheerleaders. Arnie Duncan was helpful in facilitating the expansion of charter schools as a matter of inner city choice. That was the argument he used. Betsy DeVos works the suburbs and, you know, is offering this fantasy that we can have side-by-side charter schools and a thriving public school system in the same communities.
Yeah, and again, we have no evidence of that. But you know, as I suggest in the book, the boosterism and cheerleading for privatization and charter schools is not about evidence. It's about effervescence. It's about let's talk about this as if it was a success, as if it had succeeded, because it is the language of choice. It sounds like it's the language of freedom. I cite the Lehman Brothers research investment report in the mid-1990s. where the investment house suggests that, in fact, public education could be the site for making tremendous profit in the future, similar to healthcare, as we were just talking about, from the 1980s. And so the goal of Lehman Brothers, and really now of the neoliberal movement in education, the privatization movement, has been to create what they called EMOs, educational maintenance organizations, very similar to HMOs, and that through privatization, you would be able to improve education. But of course, Lehman Brothers wasn't so motivated to improve education as they were to make a profit. And privatization has made trillions of dollars now for these private corporations, but there's absolutely no evidence that by and large, they even keep up with the public schools when it comes to achievement levels, let alone actually surpass them. So what is interesting to me about the book is I actually wrote it assuming Hillary Clinton was going to be president.
Sorry.
And so much of the process of what I was talking about, I already saw as part and parcel of the new Democratic Leadership Conference and the Clinton and the Obama administration and their educational policies under Arne Duncan's leadership were incredibly focused on privatization. What I think happens with Donald Trump, and I do suggest in the book briefly, is that Donald Trump is simply the perfect crystallization of all of these ideas. And so the idea that he would bring in DeVos to head education, who doesn't believe in public education, or he would bring in Rick Perry to run the energy department while he, in fact, supported cutting it when he could remember which one he wanted to cut.
Right.
That he brings in someone like Carson to do housing and urban development. Oklahoma to do the EPA.
Scott Pruitt.
Scott Pruitt. These are almost putting, you know, the thumb in, you know, thumbing his nose at these public institutions, right?
Well, you're being too polite, if I may. I call it the wrecking crew, and this started under Reagan, where, you know, James Watt was put in as Interior Secretary,
right.
And these are people who, you know, their views are antithetical to the mission of the agencies that they're put in charge of. And sure. What we're seeing Pruitt do, he's the most aggressive in dismantling EPA rules at the agency level, eviscerating enforcement, ignoring the scientists who are on his staff in favor of a handful of people who come from lobbyists and industry positions, some affiliated with the Koch brothers. It is stunning to see how the Democrats really failed to put up a fight. They knocked off one, the burger guy who was going to be labor secretary, and there was one other guy who withdrew because it was too complicated to explain where he kept all his money. But the Democrats, really did, they put up a little fuss over Jeff Sessions as attorney general, but they rubber stamped most of these people. And we are left just to sit back and, let our jaws drop to the floor as they embrace pollution, dirty water, exploitation of public lands. It is a stunning reversal, and it will continue.
And don't forget, Jeff Sessions, of course, now is taking the past 20 years, probably closer to 10 years, of the rollback of some of the worst draconian policies around drugs and crime, around everything from maximum minimum sentences and three strikes penalties to the actual getting rid of things like solitary confinement and some of the worst abuses and torture that's gone on in prisons. And he's trying to bring them back. And so, you know, even law enforcement in most states is not supportive of the attorney general's move to try and recriminalize drug addiction and opioids at the moment we're in this terrible crisis. So I think you're absolutely right. The wrecking crew, again, Kill It to Save It, is all about this wrecking crew and what they've done to devastate our country.
You cite Naomi Klein in the book, and she's a heroine of mine. Her book, Shock Doctrine, I think is really informative. And it was interesting reading when it was about how the Chicago school would be called in to revamp the economy in Chile or in Russia. But we're now the targets of the shockers and their doctrines. And as we see, the gains that have occurred over the last 40 or 50 years are now largely at risk. Things that there was so much consensus on, like contraception, okay, just as a as a meaningful personal a form of personal liberty and a form of societal restraint, if you will, that's now being tossed out in favor of Christianist ideology. And, you know, Mike Pence's Indiana is now a leader in teen pregnancies, STDs, undiagnosed breast cancer, and he can claim victory because he kicked out Planned Parenthood. But people are actually suffering and dying because of these policies. And in most cases, it's treated as a, oh, well, yeah, somebody else, not me.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And again, it's discouraging how successful the ideology is. And I think that part of the success has been this ability to tap into this narrative and then really bolster this narrative that continues to kind of keep our eyes off of the prize. On the first level, you know, the media is now obsessed with Russia 24/7, right? And while I would love to know the specifics of the levels of thuggery that this White House is responsible for, the amount of damage that's being done by this administration already, not even counting executive orders, but as you suggested, what Pruitt is doing in the EPA, and what Sessions is doing as Attorney General, I think that they are creating these crises and as opportunities that are devastating what's left of our democracy. I think one of the best examples of this that we're only just finding out about right now is this committee that Trump put together to investigate voter fraud. Now, the media has covered it as one of those Trump non-issues. You know, fake news, fake facts. There clearly has not been voter fraud to any degree whatsoever in this country. Study after study demonstrates that. Yet, clearly, it was in Trump's psyche that he needed to justify his loss in the popular vote. And so he went ahead and put forward this narrative about huge voter fraud. Well, it would be one thing if he just set this committee up to kind of assuage his own ego. But what we're actually finding out is that this created crisis, this constructed crisis, the shock doctrine, as Naomi Klein would suggest, means that this committee is now trying to not only destroy the little democracy that we know, they're trying to restrict voters. They're looking to use this committee to implement even more strict voter registration laws throughout the country, to take back things like mail-in voting and mail-in registration, all the things that increase the ability for people to vote. This will limit it. But also, they're now trying to get information from the secretaries of states of throughout the country. They want Social Security numbers. They want some of our most personal information to be given away by the state to this national security complex. Now, many, I think 46 now or 48 secretaries of state have said no. Many of them are Republicans.
There's some interesting clarification there, Corey. Greg Pallast is the reporter who last year uncovered the interstate cross-check list that Chris Kobach, Kansas Secretary of State, was running.
Right.
Kobach now co-chair or vice chair of this voter fraud commission. You're correct. It is a ruse to enable further voter suppression. However, Pallast points out that at least 28 of the states that are now saying, oh, we're not going to cooperate, including Kansas, okay,
right.
which is highly ironic, they've already turned over that interview to Kobach for the interstate cross-check list. And Pallast goes out of his way. He issued a statement yesterday that the Secretary of State of Mississippi, who said that if they want our voter information, they can go jump in the Gulf of Mexico, he turned it over in January.
Well, so now we have what is classically a turf war over who's going to actually control the management of this database. But I think, as you suggest, this database is clearly going to be used not only to further voter suppression, but in fact to further the observing and the maintenance and managing of the entire population.
Well, and Corey, just for your information, I did not support Hillary Clinton in the election last year, but I believe she won, not just the popular vote. I happened to be in Ohio on early voting Sunday, the day, a couple of days before the election, and John Husted there had changed the rules so that early voting could only occur in one location per county. Well, Cincinnati has a million people, Hamilton County. There was one polling place open. People were waiting 4 hours in line to vote. There were at one point 800 people in line. And I went to the end of the line and I watched people show up and say, oh, I'm out of here. And that form of voter suppression is obvious. It's visible. But the other methods, the photo ID, the demand for citizenship documents that many people can't put their fingers on, these are all just different ways to prevent likely Democrats from voting.
No, that's absolutely right. And of course, you know, we could talk about Citizens United and we could talk about all the different ways in which wealth and power in this country solidify their wealth and power by controlling what few democratic mechanisms we actually still have. And of course, the media is one of those, probably in some ways the most important. And I think, you know, Fox News and other right-wing media outlets could take that message so far and certainly have been successful. But I think that we're now in the Steve Bannon alt-right phase of this, where we're actually moving beyond simply having a right-wing outlet that competes with the mainstream media for airtime. Now we're looking at the kind of dismantling of our sense of facts, the dismantling of our sense of reality, which is really, I think, making a large segment of our population, not the majority, but certainly a core of that 30% that still supports Donald Trump, into a significantly alternate type of universe where some of the very basic things we know to be true are questioned.
Well, and I want to commend John Oliver on HBO. On his most recent show, he exposed Sinclair Broadcasting. And most Americans never heard of this chain of station owners. They currently operate in something like 40 markets, and they just have come to a deal with the Tribune Company to buy all of their TV stations. And I used to serve on the National Union Board of AFTRA, and we represent the people on air at television stations across the country. And Sinclair was the cheapest operator. They were early on syndicating portions of their local newscasts. The sports guy was in Baltimore, no matter where you were. The weather guy or girl was in Baltimore in a cheap warehouse, and all that stuff was pre-recorded and fed out to the local stations to be inserted so they could keep their costs down. Well, they inject their right-wing views in the same centrally controlled manner. And John Oliver exposed that in a brilliant way, even showing how stories are scripted from headquarters, and the local talking head blonde will read it word for word. And they were able to intercut from one station to the next where the anchors were reading from the exact same script. And Sinclair's politics are more virulent than even the Fox News Channel.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. More right-wing than Murdoch. But now think about it, because I write about this quite a bit in the book. That is, in essence, the media version of ALEC.
Uh-huh.
That's the media version of the American Legislative Exchange Council.
You just read my mind, Professor. That's where I was going next. I'm really pleased that you included ALEC as kind of the undercurrent of many of the kill it to save it issues that you write about right in the book.
No, that's right. And I think from their, you know, their founding really in the 1970s, but certainly the way they have been a focus of the Koch brothers and other, you know, kind of corporate political alliances over the last decade or so has been vital to their success. And so if you think about the way it's done, it's brilliant. And the Koch brothers are certainly brilliant in many ways. The focus now on state government And the focus on spending money to not only elect state officials, but then to redistrict and create even more impenetrable strongholds for the right wing, allows them to pass legislation. But the question then is, well, what legislation should we pass? And so the American Legislative Exchange Council has been behind not only the kinds of policies, say, as I suggest in the book, the prison industrial complex, the privatization of prisons. Once you privatize prisons, then you have to fill them up. So you pass maximum minimum sentencing laws and three strikes laws. Then you create a whole bail industry now that is not only about ripping off people who are assessed civil fines, but then ultimately and eventually imprisoning them when they can't pay the fees on the fines that the bail industry has instituted.
California is taking a hard look at that. And Governor Brown, about a year and a half ago, asked the legislature for a bill, and he got it, that we no longer suspend the driver's licenses of people who can't pay their fines. And they're working on a reduction of the bail system to limit it to the most serious crimes. And you're correct, this creates a perpetual cycle of people, and this was really made clear in Ferguson, Missouri, where the police force is funded by penalizing the impoverished residents and dunning them and then suspending their licenses and then putting them in jail for their inability to pay the fines that accumulate.
No, that's right. And if we get down to some of the very basics of what a democracy ought to be, the most important thing that we as citizens, as humans in any kind of society need is information. We need knowledge, and we need to be able to have access to that information to know what's going on. The idea that so much of what has happened over the last couple of decades through groups like ALEC and through, say, the prison industrial complex in particular, in the ways in which municipal courts work and municipal policing works, it's if we look at the Department of Justice study on Ferguson or their study on Baltimore, we can see the myriad ways these things work, not only to oppress a racial minority, but also to create a privatization model off of their suffering. But if you think about what Trump and what his cohort now would suggest is they don't even want us to be able to get that information. And so all of these agencies, whether it's the Department of Justice or the EPA, we can't even get the information we need to make the decisions that are necessary in a democracy. And ALEC certainly not only robs us of that through these bill mills that essentially they run, but also that they even support the kind of laws that limit and restrict information and knowledge and even restrict free speech. You mentioned John Oliver. I think he did an amazing episode a couple years back on chicken farmers. Mm-hmm. And the way in which not only had chicken farmers, as I suggest, have become chicken tenders, the chickens aren't theirs. They simply, you know, rent them to build their bodies up to good meat weight. And then the companies take them back. They're constantly in debt. But when they try to speak out about the conditions within which they farm, which essentially are sharecroppers' conditions, they can't. They are not even allowed to talk about the conditions within which they work because it's considered proprietary information by the companies. Mm-hmm. And so on a constant day-to-day basis, people in this country are restricted both from getting the information they need and speaking out about the conditions they have because we've created a legal system that won't allow it.
And thank you for mentioning my old pal Percy Schmeiser, the Canadian who took on Monsanto because their Roundup Ready seeds blew onto his property, and then they blamed him for it. And he had to take that all the way to the Supreme Court in Canada. You devote an entire chapter to trying to explain Marco Rubio, and I would submit that is a fool's errand. But share with our listeners why you think that Marco Rubio is worth analyzing.
Well, I'll suggest this. On the one hand, I think, you know, Donald Trump represents the, as I said, the crystallization, the epitome of the corporate triumph over democracy. The epitome of the kind of kill it to save it framework that really suggests this country, if not the entire planet, is for the benefit and really the ravaging of a corporate elite. But I think Marco Rubio really represents and crystallizes the ability for a narrative to come to be that legitimizes that for the underdog. In other words, one couldn't imagine the naked emperor without his constituents, without his citizenry, pretending he was still dressed. And I would suggest that Marco Rubio represents the epitome of the masses who continue to suggest that the naked emperor is clothed. So, for example, Marco Rubio is the product of a strong public sector. Marco Rubio is the product of parents who were able to support him growing up with decent jobs because they belonged to unions. He grew up primarily in Las Vegas, which is a union town. We could talk about the merits of gambling, but certainly the merits of a union job in those casinos is crucial. They had union protections. He had health coverage through his parents' union. When he moved to Dade County, back to Florida, he was a beneficiary of one of the strongest urban public school districts in the country, the best bilingual education program in the country at the time. And after going to a private college that went bust because of their corruption around student loans and recruitment, of which Marco Rubio was part of, being recruited with a football scholarship, despite his second string status at his own high school. He was able to come back, go to a community college, well-funded, very inexpensive, and then graduate from the University of Florida, which back in the 1990s was an incredibly expensive, great public education. Now, and actually just fast forward, he even speaks very highly of Medicare when he is first elected, and talks about his parents' use of Medicare and how much that was important for them as they went through health crises in their older years. All of this gets wrapped up in Marco Rubio's contemporary policy proposals and his contemporary ideology, in which he gives a very famous speech, I think famous, on the House of the Senate, and suggests that we no longer are a society of haves and have-nots. In fact, America has never been a society of haves and have-nots. We're a society of haves and soon-to-haves. And he makes the argument that people in this country have never fought to try and take money away from other people or take what people have earned away from them, that we're a society in which we look to our own opportunities as the way to make things more equal. We drive through expensive neighborhoods and we don't look at these neighborhoods and feel bitter or resentful. We look around and say, we'll be here soon. Well, aside from the historical reality that, in fact, there have been numerous social movements throughout our history where people demanded a redistribution of wealth, and that, in fact, working people, whether through the labor movement or veterans through the Bonus March and Coxey's Army, suggested that they deserved their fair share. It also suggests a total amnesia about how he came to become a senator in the first place.
So two things, Corey. As you were talking about Marco Rubio, I just have this sudden thirst. I had to sip water the entire time. And as you were describing his family history and his access of to public facilities and entities, it reminded me of Obama saying, "You didn't build that," and how the Republicans instantly turned that into their convention theme in 2012, as if the infrastructure, the commons, all of the public facilities were gifts of the oligarchs and not things that were paid for by middle-class taxpayers.
No, that's right. And I would argue that, you know, Jimmy Carter never fought hard enough to make that narrative successful in countering Reagan's kind of rugged, burly individualist, make America great again by unleashing individual entrepreneurial bluster. But it was certainly Bill Clinton who put the final nails, to my mind, in that public sector coffin by arguing that we needed smaller government, by accepting that ruse that Republicans really since John Birch had been promoting, that we needed to reduce the size of government, and that we needed to limit what the government would offer to people as part of their entitlements as citizens and as people on the planet, let alone citizens of this country. And so whether it was welfare reform or the crime bill, you know, Bill Clinton set in motion this rightward movement of the Democratic Party, which really has been the rightward movement of America ever since.
Yeah, oh, I fully agree. And Corey, as we wrap up here, what are your ideas for overcoming this kill it to save it mentality and returning to some semblance of a rational understanding of how government works, what taxpayers contribute, and what citizens can expect under their contract, which we call the Constitution?
That's right. That's right. And I would say it's that public contract that we have to reinforce. And it's that, you know, Newt Gingrich's contract with America, that Personal Responsibility Act, that we really need to dismantle. I see two things happening. One is that the rise of protest and demonstration against much of what Donald Trump has been proclaiming is optimistic to me. I feel enthusiastic about it, partly because, especially the airport protests with the travel ban, how many people went out immediately without the kind of planning that, say, went into the Women's March. To go out to airports, which are the worst fucking places on the planet, and spend hour after hour, day after day there willingly, and often in support of people who they might not even know, but certainly people that weren't themselves in what the travel ban was doing. You could argue we all suffer because we suffer the loss of democracy and freedom, but in fact, certainly it was primarily Muslims who were affected by it. So I think that's encouraging. I think the more people get involved on a local basis, more people are running for office, but I think we need to redefine what we even think of democracy, and getting back to Frankie Moore Lopez's new book, Daring Democracy, I think this notion of getting back to some of the real heart and soul of what communities can do, people getting involved in school boards, people getting involved in warding off privatization. The state of Massachusetts, I think, did a great job in warding off the removal of caps on privatization. I think more and more communities have to do that. What's happening in California is optimistic, not only around bail legislation, but also around climate change. More and more cities around the country are taking climate change seriously enough that they're going to meet the accord, the demands of the Paris Accords, regardless of what the United States is going to do. Sanctuary cities. We have to hold fast to these on a local basis. And I believe that the beginnings of this are there. What we will need to do over the next few years is come together as a more national mobilization, and probably an international mobilization, where we recognize that so many of these issues, whether it's around our prison industrial complex, our environment, our healthcare, our local infrastructure that's crumbling, our schools, that many different ways, these are all interconnected, and they're interconnected probably most primarily through the notion of democracy, that people can come together and argue and debate, but in the end, we can agree on certain basic things. And I really believe that no matter how far right or left you are, we really do believe that food, clothing, healthcare, education, housing are the most basic principles for all human rights. And until we guarantee those as a world, we will not solve the problems that we face today.
And do we need to make modifications to the capitalist system?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Whether we call it socialism, we have to find a way to regulate the economy for the benefit of everyone. As a sociologist, economies are the ways in which we produce and distribute the goods and commodities necessary for survival. And it seems to me that we can't rely on a system based on private ownership and private profit to do that for us. And I think time and time again, we've watched the more unregulated our market becomes, the more unequal it becomes, and the more devastating and brutal it becomes. In fact, I was talking with Frankie earlier today, and she used the term brutal capitalism. Mm-hmm. You know, we can call it neoliberalism or late capitalism, but right now it's a very brutal capitalism.
Oh,
so can the capitalist system be saved from itself? I think Franklin Delano Roosevelt tried to do that. I think that there are certainly possibly ways to improve it, but ultimately I think that we're looking towards some kind of very different economic system that guarantees these basic rights to people.
And Corey, you're speaking to us from the Institute for a Small Planet. That is the think tank and activism center of Frances Moore LePay and her daughter,
That's right.
Anna. And explain a little bit about your connections. Is this like some kind of a communist cabal? Because we know that if you're not
we're hoping.
Oh, okay. If you're not a hardline capitalist, I listen to right-wing talk radio, and there's only one other category, and that's communist. There's nothing in between. What? Socialism, nah, you know, it's just communism.
No, that's right. Well, you know, look, first of all, you know, we could have another conversation much longer about the distinction between communism and socialism. But regardless of what we call it, it seems to be pretty clear that we haven't had it yet. What we need is something that we have no label for yet. I think socialism as the idea of a redistributive economy that guarantees basic human rights to people, my adage has always been, if people want to have a second house or a second car or something more and want to work harder for it, I think that's great. I don't think that they should be guaranteed it by their birth. And I think that the irony in this country, where we supposedly believe that people who work hard get ahead, what we find out is the people who are furthest ahead don't have to work hard. It's the people who are the furthest behind that work hard that can't get ahead. And so, you know, we used to say in my graduate student days in Ann Arbor, Michigan, that no person should have two homes until everyone has one. It seems to me it's quite possible that John McCain, with his 9 or 10, so many houses he can't count them, you know, could be the beneficiary of a public sector that was healthier and a public sector that was better informed, even if that required him giving up a couple of those homes.
I'm sure Ben Carson is ready to Section 8 several of them if he just gets the opportunity, you know? Corey, it's been a real pleasure talking with you, and I recommend your book, Kill It to Save It, An Autopsy of Capitalism's Triumph Over Democracy. There's a lot more than we talked about in the book, and I enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Corey Dolgan. Your comments and feedback are welcome. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.